Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The IRS Direct File program aims to make things easier on some taxpayers. Direct File helps them file their tax returns for free to the IRS website. It's running a pilot this filing season, as a matter of fact. The IRS may have been a bit off, though, when estimating how much the program will actually cost. That's the finding of the Government Accountability Office. Federal News Network's Eric White got more from the GAO's Director of Strategic Issues, Jay McTeague.
So why don't we just start from the beginning and lay out how the direct file tax system would work for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it. It's not quite out in the open yet, as IRS is still trying it out.
Right. So Direct File is a new IRS system for preparing and filing a tax return online for free. As you said, IRS is piloting the system now during the 2024 tax filing system or season. Someone interested in using Direct File would simply go to irs.gov and log into Direct File. Then the taxpayer answers interview-style questions to prepare and electronically submit their tax return to IRS without the help or cost of a third party. The pilot is currently open to taxpayers with simple tax situations residing in 12 states. And an example of a simple tax situation is a taxpayer with wage income taking the standard deduction and maybe claiming the child tax credit or the earned income tax credit. IRS has been working with the U.S. Digital Services, taxpayers, state revenue offices, and others on this project. And Eric, I'd like to note that we, in addition to the report that we just issued, we're continuing to assess the operation of the pilot and options for Direct File going forward. And so we'll be issuing another report later this year.
Gotcha. And, I don't know if it's quite come to fruition yet, but what would the IRS be doing with the program? Would they be overseeing, making sure that, that all the boxes are checked and all the I's are dotted on that after a taxpayer files it through this program?
Yes. There are basic quality control checks built into the system, and IRS has noted that it hopes that taxpayers may make it easier for taxpayers to claim certain tax benefits, especially deductions, that they're eligible for that they might not otherwise be aware of.
All right. So let's get down to brass tacks. How much does the agency say the program will cost? And after looking into it, is that an accurate assessment coming from you all?
Right. So in May of last year, IRS reported to Congress that the annual costs of a direct file system could range between $64 million to up to $240 million, depending upon the number of taxpayers served and the complexity of tax situations supported by the system. As of the end of this January, IRS reported that approximately $9.4 million had been spent on the program. As for how accurate the estimate is, we did identify opportunities for improvement. And, IRS did follow some best practices for good cost estimation. For example, the agency did describe assumptions used to calculate their estimate, and they also analyzed how the cost might change if certain assumptions, like the number of taxpayers using the system, changed. However, IRS did not include some important costs, such as startup costs, which could be substantial in a new system like this. And furthermore, the estimate was not documented.
And when you say startup costs and, getting the infrastructure in place to make sure the system is running well, when it eventually, I imagine, expands, what does that mean? And, just how much money are we talking about there?
Sure. That's the million-dollar question, Eric. And IRS told us that the U.S. Digital Services, which is part of the Office of Management and Budget and the Executive Office of the President, actually developed the prototype that evolved into the direct file system. And because IRS is not required to reimburse USDS for its employees, IRS reported no costs for the prototype. Currently, IRS is using about 29 employees from the U.S. Digital Services to supplement their own staff. And IRS could not provide any additional information on the extent of USDS resources used for direct file. IRS did note in their report to Congress last year that while technology investments could be substantial. A lot of the running costs or the operating costs would actually be for customer service. And, you know, that's why we think, as we indicated in the report, that the pilot that IRS is currently conducting really is an opportunity for IRS to collect additional data, which could help improve their cost estimates going forward. And, you know, in some examples of what kind of data that we're talking about is, you know, how much time does it take employees to help taxpayers as they navigate, you know, direct file? And then on the technology side that we were talking about, IRS has been testing data transfer capabilities that would allow data from the federal return to populate state filing systems. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, that system or that capability could be expanded, obviously there could be additional costs associated with that. And so these types of data, you know, would help inform a more robust cost estimate for the program.
Kind of ironic coming from an agency that gives you guff every time you overestimate or underestimate the value of something. We're speaking with James McTighe of the Government Accountability Office. So what's at stake here if the IRS doesn't have a proper cost assessment before they head into, you know, full implementation? I imagine, you know, we're probably very, very far off from that. But it is probably a good idea to keep in mind of just how much this is going to cost the agency, since dollars aren't easy to get from Congress, especially for the IRS.
That's a great point. And, you know, for any program or any agency, an accurate cost estimate is very important. You know, good cost estimates support good decisions about funding one program over another, or to evaluate the resources at key decision points as to, you know, in this case, whether to expand the program, terminate the program, you know, support different tax situations, and other key questions like that. And then finally, you know, cost is a very important performance measurement. And, you know, it's customer service is another, but, you know, together, performance has to be assessed in a holistic manner. You know, quite frankly, having realistic cost estimates informs how to manage a program and, you know, increases the probability of that the program will be successful. And I know, you know, this is a new system, new territory for IRS, and initial cost estimates are going to have all kinds of uncertainties, but a full range of costs, you know, can help inform the decisions that IRS will need to make as it decides whether or not to make the program permanent or consider additional tax situations that I described.
Yeah, on that decision, in your review, has the agency said anything about the benefits of this kind of system? Because it seems as if there is an opportunity to save some money there if you're not having to go after people who, for non-malicious reasons, messed up on their tax returns. You know, if they're able to just work up front with the IRS at first, is there a benefit there? And is that what they mean in saying there is a certain cost benefit to a system such as the one that they're describing?
Sure. I agree with what you said. You know, to the extent that IRS can make filing a tax return easier and more straightforward for taxpayers, the more likelihood there is that taxpayers will be compliant and pay the taxes that they owe or get the refund that they deserve. In addition to that, I would add a couple things. You know, there are potential cost savings to both taxpayers and the IRS. And IRS actually put a number on, you know, the potential benefit to taxpayers. You know, based on certain assumptions, IRS estimated that taxpayers potentially could save up to $21 million in money they otherwise would have paid commercial preparers or tax professionals, as well as the, you know, the value of their own time spent on the process. And as far as IRS has been trying to reduce the amount of paper that it deals with, and it identified an estimated 200,000 paper filers who may be eligible to participate in the pilot and file the return electronically, which is much easier and efficient for IRS to process.
Jay McTeague, Director of Strategic Issues at the Government Accountability Office, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. Find this interview along with a link to the IRS report at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, What do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well.
Thank you.
Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.